The economic developments of this past week have many people feeling stunned, extremely worried, and quite confused. So we've decided to devote today's Please Explain segment to sorting out what actually happened and consider what might happen next. Joining me now are Greg Ipp, the U.S. economics editor for The Economist, and Andrew Kaplan, professor of economics at New York University. And I'm very pleased to welcome them to the show. Hi.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
I've heard so many different explanations about what happened on the various news shows that I'm not exactly sure what to believe. Greg, is there a way of putting it in a nutshell?
I don't know if it would be a nutshell, maybe several nutshells, Leonard, but I think that it starts quite a few years ago when the housing market took off and eventually became a bubble. And people bought houses at prices that were not sustainable, and they took out mortgages to purchase those houses. In the old days, those mortgages would have remained on the books of the banks. But nowadays, banks routinely sell those mortgages so that they can take the money and make new loans. And the resulting mortgages get packaged into a variety of securities, and they get sliced and diced and distributed around the world. And this all worked fine as long as housing prices kept going up, because it meant that the mortgages never went into default. In the worst-case scenario, you could sell the house and pay off the loan. Once housing prices started to decline, the mortgages began to default.
Somebody, forgive me for interrupting. Somebody said it was almost like a Ponzi scheme, even though it wasn't exactly, because it was assumed that if you bought, you know, your neighbor bought that house at $40,000, sold it for $250,000. If you bought your house for $250,000, you were guaranteed to be able to sell it for a half of or $800,000 somewhere down the line.
You know, we've had bubbles almost as long as we've had markets. They go back hundreds of years, and they all more or less look like this, which is that people delude themselves into thinking that no matter what price they buy something for, they can find something else to buy it at a higher price. And they all more or less end the same way, sometimes with differing degrees of pain. And what happened in this case was that the people who owned the mortgages, as those mortgages defaulted, suddenly began to lose large sums of money. And some of them were lending firms, and the loss of money resulted in them becoming insolvent.
So a house of cards?
Well, I'm not sure I would say that, but what we have discovered is that the financial system was much more fragile than we realized. And the system could sustain a small number of firms going bust, which is exactly what happened in 2007 with companies like New Century. But then you took down companies like Lehman Brothers, which are quite different. They are much larger, and they're much more interconnected. They owe a lot of money to a wide variety of people, such as people who bought their debt and put it in a money market mutual fund, and they have relationships with a lot of people. And so when they went bankrupt, that cost a lot of people a lot of money in many different places. And the nature of these panics is that when one firm goes down, investors look around, they simply ask who looks like it and who's next. And so they now worry that maybe Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch or Goldman Sachs will be next. And they begin to pull their money out of anything that has any remote possibility of failing. And all they want to do is put it in the safest thing possible. And when they do not want to put that money into other types of investments, companies can no longer borrow as they routinely must in order simply to, for example, buy inventories or build factories. And individuals can't borrow to buy cars and houses, and then the economy suffers.
Andrew, the last economic crisis occurred at the end of Bill Clinton's term when the tech and dot-com bubbles burst. Now we have this housing bubble burst. Were they all encouraged by government policies?
It's a very interesting political economic cycle that's given rise to what happened. In fact, if you go right back to the beginnings of the mortgage-backed securities market, it was, ironically, a government invention. What happened was during the 1930s, going back to the Depression, there were mortgages issues that were called balloon mortgages. And with a balloon mortgage, what would happen is at the end of the term, which would be very short, say 7 years, you'd have to go and reborrow the same money. Basically, you hadn't paid it down at all. So when house prices collapsed in the Depression, that meant that people couldn't reborrow the money they needed to repay the balloon mortgages. So the government stepped in, this was the last major effort to revamp markets, and said, we would like to support a new type of mortgage, a 30-year fixed-rate self-amortizing mortgage, very standard, the one that we currently live with. And this is back in the 1930s it was introduced. They then had to get it financed, which meant they had to get buyers to come in, and they set up the institutions such as Fannie Mae to actually supply capital to the markets.
So Fannie Mae has been working pretty well until now, and suddenly Fannie Mae doesn't work anymore.
Well, Fannie Mae, it created a strange political economic cycle where you have the politicians can lean on Fannie Mae and say, by the way, there's an affordability crisis now. House prices are rising too fast. You've got to lend more. So there's more pressure on, you know, in any district who wouldn't want their people to get a little bit more housing finance. It's very convenient for everybody when new mortgages were found that were a little bit like the old balloon mortgages that let yet more people buy houses. So everybody was, the politicians, frankly, were busy patting themselves on the back. Everybody in the business sector was saying, we're doing great. And the question, I think, became, does it die with a bang, because it had to die, or does it die with a little, oh, slow down, now let's stop and let's rethink?
Well, both candidates are now saying this was because regulation, well, they weren't regulated enough. But banks and investment banks are both in trouble, and they used to be heavily regulated, weren't they?
I don't see this as well described as too little regulation. I do think it's very poorly thought through regulation. There hasn't been a revamping since the 1930s. And for example, there are types of mortgage that I've been thinking about for a long time that probably would have been better and are banned by the tax code. So it's not about regulation.
Well, the reason I ask that is because there was a time when banks were limited as to what they could do. Everybody had a specific role, and today, as Greg has suggested, and I want to get Greg in here again as well, there seemed to have been some domino effect, and that's because everything seemed to be interconnected. There weren't those defined roles that we had in the past before deregulation. Am I wrong in thinking that way?
Well, I think it has always been the case that when you bring in regulations as we do, is that it affects what parts of the economy grow fast. So banks have always been heavily regulated. And what that meant was that because regulations tend to add costs and slow down your ability to grow, other companies and sectors tend to pick up the slack and they tend to grow faster. And in fact, the largest area of mortgage origination turned out to be not the banks, but mortgage brokers and standalone finance companies, some of which were actually owned by investment banks, such as Lehman Brothers. And while in theory the rules that govern who they could give a mortgage to should have been the same, they were not evenly managed. For example, Wells Fargo's bank would have had to answer to the inspectors from the Federal Reserve or the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency for the quality of the mortgages that they underwrote. But for mortgage finance companies, many of these people answered only to state regulators who had a much lighter hand, if they had any hand at all. And you have to remember that nobody probably made these mortgages, at least at the beginning, expecting that they were going to go bust, because it's really not in their interest to make a mortgage that's not going to go bust. But a few things did change in the nature of our markets. For example, now that banks no longer hold mortgages for the long term, the person making the mortgage gets a fee, often for originating that mortgage, and then the final paper is passed on to somebody else. So they have less incentive, as it were, to ensure they make the loan to somebody who will ultimately pay it off.
I agree with that. There's a gradual process of edging away from the high standards that were initially imposed. So what initially happened was that to start the markets, they had to check people for loan-to-value ratio, for income, and they had to check them for credit quality. Subprime was when they started relaxing one, and by the end, they'd relaxed all three of those. That's the stew, and it was piece by piece, and each single piece didn't seem too bad, and there was no evidence that one of them was the straw, you know, until the straw broke the camel's back, basically.
Now, John McCain has placed the blame on Wall Street. To me, Wall Street is stocks and bonds. Is this a reflection of another aspect of Wall Street activity, or are we talking about problems at Washington Mutual Bank?
A personal take, I don't enjoy blame-casting exercises. I mean, this is a very understandable way the market progressed, and it's very sad, and the only question was how bad would its ending be? I think, you know, to the extent that it was a bubble, everybody knew it was going to end somewhere. The trouble is predicting the day.
Greg, the main players in the government are the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve. Can you give us the briefest description of their roles and what has happened?
Certainly. Well, the Treasury Department is the oldest of the government departments. It was founded at the same time as the Republic. The first Treasury Secretary was Alexander Hamilton. And its traditional job is to manage the nation's finances, which means to raise money for the operations of the government. And it does this by issuing bonds and by collecting taxes and then distributing the proceeds for the various jobs that the government does. Another job that has basically acquired over time is to be the agency that links the government to the markets. And it's always been the agency that goes to work when there's a crisis. So we saw that, for example, with the bailouts of Mexico and some of the other emerging markets in the 1990s, and we're seeing it now. The Federal Reserve is the nation's central bank, and it was created in 1913. We think of its main job now as managing interest rates so that we have maximum employment and low inflation. And it does this by essentially taking its stock of treasury bonds and buying or selling those from day to day, and that adjusts the size of its balance sheet and the amount of credit in the economy. This causes interest rates to go up and down. But it has another job, which in fact was a job it was originally given, which is to keep the financial system stable, that if a bank had a run on it, the Fed would lend money to it so that it could meet its obligations and not fail. And it can do this because it can print the money when it's needed, and then it can basically unprint the money when it's no longer needed. And that is why it is called the lender of last resort, and it is always turned to in a crisis like this.
Now, Andrew, you said you don't believe in blame, but John McCain has blamed the head of the SEC for much of this problem. Many people have been blaming Alan Greenspan for creating the environment that has led to the housing bubble.
Well, my take would be to do the analysis of it and understand that mostly it came from forces that we can understand. There's not one person who could have stopped this. I think we need the crisis, and the hope is now that it's typical that you don't look at a problem until it breaks. Now let's look at the problem and let's assess what to do next, but with fuller imagination and everybody at the table.
A federal regulation change that prevents short selling was just implemented. How is that expected to play a role in turning things around, Greg?
Well, a short sale is basically works like this. Supposing you see a stock that's trading at $50 and you think it should only be worth $30 and you'd like to profit from that view, what you do is you go to your broker and say, can I borrow somebody else's shares at $50 and sell them? And the broker says yes. You sell them, you collect your $50, and then when it falls to $30, you buy them back from somebody else and you give them back to the person you borrowed them from. And short selling is a very normal part of markets because we should have people out there who can act on a view of a stock being overvalued. And it's not uncommon to hear corporations and chief executives constantly complaining about short sellers because CEOs always think their stock should go higher. So having short sellers is actually a vital part of having honest markets. The thing that the regulators have worried about is that it has become abusive, that some people have done short selling and then spread rumors that are not true about the companies that they have bet on going down and therefore made profits on these lies. And this can build on itself as the stock goes down, the sense of weakness of the company builds, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that is why they brought in these fairly drastic rules to try and crack down on the practice.
If it had been made earlier, would it have made a difference for Lehman Brothers?
It's very hard to say, and I suppose that there will be very careful investigations of this question. There are definitely shortcomings to taking this step. For one thing, a lot of people can now take bets against companies that do not actually involve their stock at all, but in very complex so-called credit derivative instruments, which are barely regulated at all, and that can still go on. And moreover, there are a lot of people who need to do short selling, not because they're trying to push a company's stock down, but because it's a routine part of the way they do business. For example, an investment dealer may have promised to sell a million shares at $50 to a client 5 days from now. Well, they're heavily exposed. They may have promised to buy a million shares from somebody. Well, they're very heavily exposed by that promise if the price of the stock goes down in the meantime, so they may enter a short sale just to hedge themselves. And when you make it more difficult for people to hedge themselves, which is what this ban on short selling has done, you may actually cause people to withdraw from the market, which would not be a good thing.
Now, Andrew, some places were hit hard. Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, then banks like Washington Mutual, the insurance company giant AIG, but others have not. Is it because the others didn't do something wrong?
I think the contagion became much more general. So let's start with those who directly were involved in the mortgage-backed securities market. They were in obvious trouble. And if they placed a bet early on that this would turn shortly, they were in trouble. So Bear Stearns was heavily involved right from the beginning. Lehman was involved and placed heavy bets that the crisis would turn sooner than it did. So they got into trouble. Now, what's happened since then is that everybody's questioning in a much more fundamental way a larger set of instruments. For example, I might say to myself, well, if people could believe that these dreadful securities were double A or A rated by an agency, do I really believe that the agencies understand risk? If they don't understand risk, how can I trust about 1,000 other new instruments that I don't think they understand very well, that they might have guaranteed? So you now start looking for the next toxic asset, and there are plenty of them.
The former head of AIG said that the bailout was a bad thing, actually, that all they needed was a loan. Now the company is being dismantled, and shareholders have lost out.
I don't think he was feeling good that day.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we invite calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You also can write your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Andrew Kaplan, professor of economics at NYU, and Greg Ipp, the U.S. economics editor at The Economist, although we should point out that this thing is spreading and is having a worldwide impact, not just an impact on the United States economy. Again, the number 212-433-9692. We'll be back right after this.
This world is in a tangle, and everybody's singing this song. Yes, this world is in a tangle, and everybody's singing this song.
We're back with Please Explain. My guests, Greg Ipp, the U.S. economics editor at The Economist, and Andrew Kaplan, professor of economics at New York University. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. But before we get to those calls, Greg, the amount of money that's being talked about is mind-boggling for most of us. $700 billion lost in a day, $300 billion being poured into global credit markets. What does all that mean? Where does the money come from? And in fact, where does it even exist?
Well, quite simply, I mean, there are a lot of assets out there. Those assets take many forms. In your 401k, you may have bonds issued by a company like General Electric or by the U.S. government. You might have stocks issued by various blue-chip companies. You might have things like exchange-traded funds, which invest in commodities. So you add that all up around the world, and you get quite a few trillions of dollars worth of stuff. Now, we might hear that, say, $700 billion in stock market value disappeared overnight, and it sounds like a big number, but when you actually put it in percentage terms, it's not that large. And in fact, the movements we've seen this week, they seem violent, but they probably wouldn't even be in the top 30 historically. And the other important thing to keep in mind is that when you or I take a hit on our 401k or a pension fund takes a hit, well, it doesn't make you feel great, but it doesn't make you go out of business because you don't really need to get to that money for quite a few years yet. This is quite different when a bank loses $1 billion or $2 billion because a bank typically only has a thin base of shareholders' equity, which is the basis for all the money that it lends and all the money that it borrows. And when it loses $1 billion, it takes away from that capital base. And in the short run, it means that they can lend less money. And if that happens to enough banks, it hurts the economy. And if it happens enough, they will completely go out of business. And that is why the government, both the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, have decided to lend money to some of these companies to prevent a broader panic. Where does the money come from? Well, ultimately, it comes from the taxpayer because the money is lent to these companies in the form of treasury borrowing in the open market. The Fed could, if it chose, simply create the money because it's a central bank, but that would cause inflation. And so ultimately, the money is always borrowed and it must always be paid back by the taxpayer. The hope is that the companies that have borrowed the money will be able to pay the money back out of the assets and income that they already have.
Well, it's hoped, but there's a good chance that we will be paying for it out of our own pockets. These people's screwed up and we're going to be paying for it, Andrew?
Well, I think it's very important what happens next. I mean, what's been announced is an intent to step in with several hundred million
dollars. Well, for example, the New York Times today, hundreds of billions in distressed mortgages could be purchased in the biggest bailout in United States history.
Yes, and I think...
Hundreds of billions.
Absolutely. And I think that in order for my daughter's tax burden not to rise horrifically, I would like to see that watched very carefully. First off, you have to monitor quality on the way in and not agree to purchase things that are fraudulent into the taxpayer. Second off, you have ways of handling those assets that in principle could make the Treasury turn a profit from the deal, to be honest. And I would like to see it try that. And there are ways to do it, but it has to step up one in terms of imagination. Right now, what it's been throwing, it's got two weapons that have been tried. One of them is words. You just say, look, if we're all calmed down, everything will be nice. That doesn't really work. The second tool is massive amounts of money. That's fine. They're throwing that. That's worthwhile. The third would be a little bit more consideration and genuine reform. And that would, it's about time for that.
Deborah from Ridgewood. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just surprised. I'm a former IT person at Goldman Sachs, a very long time ago. But I remember there were floors of risk analysts that sat around, and all they did was modeling of types of risk projections here, risk projections there. We did computer modeling doing all this stuff. So why was all of this data ignored?
Andrew?
Yeah, there is actually a very sad answer in the case of housing assets. These mortgages were bundled, and people treated them as if they were debt instruments. I mean, they looked like it. It's a mortgage, and you should follow debt patterns. But they weren't. They're really, in essence, part ownership of homes. Nobody really understands anything about house values. What you will not have seen at Goldman Sachs is a desk looking at the value of a house in Idaho. That's just not what they were studying. So they simply have been missing the underlying asset and to this day don't understand them.
You mean to tell me that very smart people did not recognize that eventually you can't explode a house's value to infinity without something happening?
They hoped it would happen on somebody else's watch.
So everyone made a profit in the interim. So it just sounds like one giant pyramid scheme to me.
It's a game that had to end, and the question was, would it end with a bang or whimper? Now we know.
And who would get caught holding the bag, which it seems like it's the taxpayer.
Absolutely, and watch that bag. That's all I'd say.
Thank you so much for calling us. Vered from New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, thank you. You know, I just wanted to make a point that the short selling may have exacerbated the problem that we have now, but it didn't cause it. So basically my question is, we had a poorly regulated financial system that allowed many of these obtuse financial derivative products, some products that even Bernanke himself said he had no idea what they were worth. On top of that, we had a pool, a massive pool of cheap money, with the Fed holding rates down as low as 1% for so long. How could Chairman Greenspan not be implicated in this?
You want to get into that, Greg?
Sure. Well, you have to sort of cast your mind back to the circumstances in the economy when the Federal Reserve lowered the interest rate to 1%. At that time, inflation had fallen quite sharply to 2 or 3, from 2 or 3% to as little as 1%, and the economy was extremely weak. Unemployment was well over 6%. The Iraq War was causing a lot of uncertainty, and there was a real concern that in this situation, the inflation could become deflation. And the policy did appear to take out some of those risks, and eventually the economy began growing quite quickly, and the Fed began to raise interest rates. But as it raised these interest rates, what it found to its confusion was that long-term mortgage rates, which would normally go up when the Fed was raising its rate, did not go up. And one of the reasons they did not go up was because foreign investors were pouring money into the United States. They were buying bonds and so forth. And therefore, the Fed's efforts to cool things off were frustrated. Greenspan had another role, however, and that was to oversee the regulation of the financial system. There are some powers that Congress gave to the Fed with respect to overseeing mortgage standards that only it can carry out. And Mr. Greenspan generally had a hands-off attitude about this sort of regulation. It is true that some regulations were passed by the Fed when he was there, but a case could be made that more could have been done on that front. Whether it would have ultimately made a difference is difficult to tell.
Now, right now, all the global markets are responding to this because the globalization has created so much of an interconnection, Andrew?
Yeah, I think everybody goes to the same worldwide sources of capital. Everybody is panicked when nobody trusts anybody.
But isn't that what happened in 1929 when the American crash affected the whole world? I know a lot of people are comparing this to the crash because this is the worst financial crisis since then. But we are also reassured that there are so many safeguards in place that it could never be as bad as the Depression. Not everybody is comforted by that.
It certainly has a depression-type set of financial events, and I don't know how many more layers would have to be revealed as weak before the financial sector could really, as it were, go down.
Greg, I've read that economists are debating the letter that the economy's path will take. Will it be a V, a U, a W, or an L? Can you explain that?
Sure. I'd first like to comment on that depression question. One thing I think that economic historians now agree is that the crash of 1929 did not cause a depression. The depression was essentially caused by the failure of the Fed and the other authorities to realize that widespread bank failures and collapsing real estate values were a threat to the economy. And Ben Bernanke, who spent his career studying the depression, knows that, and that is why he has responded so aggressively and so creatively to this crisis.
Breaking all the rules that this administration has said were it believed.
Exactly,
it's going against the whole philosophy of the Bush administration.
Well, yeah. Now, I mean, one could say in the end that he will overdo it, create a lot of moral hazard, put taxpayers' money at risk unnecessarily. We will never really know, though, if we manage to have avoided a much more calamitous economic outcome. And that's really where the judgment has to be made. Now,
The other question, maybe I'll throw it to Andrew, is
sure.
On the letter. Do you know whether this is going to be a V, a U, a W, or an L?
I mean, it's a scary picture. I'm not so good at that.
V means a quick recovery.
Sure.
The U means it stays down for a while. The W means up and down, up and down.
I think
many people are saying this is an L. It's going down, and then it's going to be a long time before we have any kind of recovery.
So let me agree with Greg that Ben Bernanke is particularly well placed to do everything that can be done in the current crisis. I still am not quite as convinced as Greg is that everything that can be done is enough. For example, this isn't just a U.S. issue. And what might happen next concerns countries in, say, Europe, where it's harder to coordinate the policy moves. And if there's a loss of confidence, I don't think anybody knows what to do.
Because if European policies have an impact, then no matter what the American government does, it won't matter.
It's not the whole world. So it's not going to be decided only by Ben. And at any rate, the issues remaining are still very complex.
Keith from New York City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to think of going forward and any changes in regulation.
But you have to do it quickly, Keith.
Is Congress capable of doing this, considering they were the regulators of the worst of the bunch in Freddie and Fannie? And
was Congress the regulator?
Congress has had a large hand in it's a political economic cycle we're in. It's not just the economy. It's the politicians have been hand in glove with it, in my opinion. So I hope that everybody can be a little panicked and think it's time to be on best behavior.
Greg, you want to add to that?
Well, Henry Paulson had already laid down the challenge to try and remake the regulatory system, because over the years, our financial industry has evolved, but the regulatory system has not evolved with it. So just to give you one example, you could get a mortgage from Citibank, or you could get it from a mortgage broker with a two-man operation. And while Citibank has to adhere to vigorous inspection standards by a variety of federal regulators, none of that applies to this two-person operation, yet it's ultimately the same type of mortgage. And that probably is not appropriate nowadays. And so it would be good to have a regulatory system that recognizes that some of the old distinctions no longer matter. I think there's a real case to be made that what is needed is not necessarily more or less regulation, but better thought out regulation.
And I guess that's up to the next Congress to come up with. Most of us are not all that sanguine about Congress doing the job as well as we would like. We've run out of time, but I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us today, talking about what's happening on Wall Street. Greg Ipp is the U.S. economics editor for The Economist. Andrew Kaplan is a professor of economics at NYU, and I'm sure your students are talking about this. This is a great thing to be talking about in class.
It's fascinating. It's the only profession that can get any interest from this.